Nyla, your family has a rich history, politically speaking, in Kashmir. Tell me about that.
All right. So my maternal grandfather was the first Muslim prime minister of Kashmir after India became an independent country and Kashmir acceded to India. He was prime minister of the state of Kashmir from 1948 until 1953. And then because of political disagreements with the first democratically elected prime minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, my grandfather's democratically elected government was ousted, and he was made a political prisoner. He was shuttled from one prison to the next for the next 22 years, so from 1953 until 1972. He returned to Kashmir after a long period of incarceration, exile, political externment. He returned to run for office in 1977 in what is still considered the fairest and the freest election in South Asia. And he won a landslide victory in that election. Despite his long absence from the political scene, his age, he was in his 70s when he returned, his ill health, his political organization won a landslide victory. So they were given that mandate by the people of Kashmir. And his biggest contribution to Kashmir was the Land to the Tiller Act. In the 1930s, Kashmir was a monarchy, which is when my grandfather was a young man and he led the political resistance in the state in that era. The society was quite feudal, and most Kashmiri Muslims were oppressed serfs who tilled lands that they had no claim to, that they had no rights to. They were more or less like indentured labor. But after my grandfather became prime minister of the state, he ratified the Land to the Tiller Act in 1951, which made peasants proprietors of the lands that they tilled overnight. And feudal lords were disenfranchised, they were dispossessed, all their powers were taken away from them with the stroke of the pen. So the inception of democracy in that society, the inception of peasant emancipation, free education for all, as well as free health care, all started with my grandfather and his regime.
Kashmir is uniquely positioned in South Asia, controlled by Pakistan, India, and the People's Republic of China.
Absolutely.
Over time.
Yes.
What has that done to the region to have that struggle for control among those countries?
So Kashmir, the part that I belong to, which is the Kashmir Valley, has been a conflict zone since 1989. That has been the battlefield of armed insurgency as well as counterinsurgency. And the state of Kashmir being divided between nuclear powers, India, Pakistan, and China, has divided the people and traumatized them economically, psychologically, politically, as well as emotionally. The people of Kashmir have an ambiguous identity because they are not able to completely identify with any one nation state. There are people in the state of Kashmir who would probably feel safer with Pakistan because of the religious affiliation and support the accession of the entire state of Jammu and Kashmir to Pakistan. There are some people who would prefer to be an autonomous unit within the Indian Union. There are some Kashmiris who feel that their rights would be protected, particularly their socioeconomic reforms that came about in the 1950s, that those would be protected only if they were given greater autonomy within the Indian Union. There are others who would prefer that the state be reunited. So the three parts, the one with India, the one with China, as well as the one with Pakistan, be reunited and become a sovereign unit. the independence, integrity, and sovereignty of which are guaranteed by India, Pakistan, China, as well as by other world powers.
How much does religion, especially conflict between Hindus and Muslims, fuel the dispute?
All right. In the past few years, we have been seeing a resurgence of religious as well as cultural fundamentalisms in South Asia. So Pakistan is now the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. It is a theocratic nation. India constitutionally is a secular republic. But in the past couple of years, we have been seeing a resurgence of Hindu fundamentalism or fanaticism called Hindutva in India, particularly with the rise of the BJP, which is the political organization now in power in the entire country, as well as in several Indian states. So the revolution or the movement of Kashmir, which was political, the movement for the autonomy, self-determination of Kashmiris, which was political in the 1930s and the 1940s, has now taken on a religious color. And the reason it's taken on that religious color is because of the burgeoning or the growth of Hindu fundamentalism in the rest of India. So what we are seeing in Kashmir is a backlash to that fundamentalism. Their way of striking out or rebelling against the growth of Hindu fanaticism is to espouse an Islamic fanaticism. And unfortunately, militant organizations that espouse Islamic fanaticism in Kashmir are supported overtly as well as covertly by Pakistan. And that dilutes the political nature of the struggle. So I think that separation between church and politics, that separation between religion and politics, is very important to maintain in order to keep alive the legitimacy of the political aspirations of the people of Kashmir. Because once politics and religion are conflated, the political nature of the struggle becomes blurred, and international observers are not able to see the line of demarcation between church and state.
With all of its conflicts, what is the geopolitical significance of Kashmir in South Asia?
So the part of Kashmir that I belong to is strategically located. We are technically part of India. We border Pakistan as well as China, making Kashmir a nuclear flashpoint between these nuclear powers. The situation is terribly volatile. The situation is terribly unpredictable. And with the growth of Islamophobia in the Western world, I think Kashmir observers, as well as political players, need to keep in mind that any conflation of the political aspirations as well as the political rights of the people of Kashmir with a puritanical form of Islam would confuse the international world and would also compel the international world to withdraw its sympathies as well as attention from the conflict, which is political as well as humanitarian.
We've just passed the year anniversary of a significant event in Kashmir. In the summer of 2016, Indian security forces killed a young leader of the local militancy who had achieved prominence, actually, through social media. That touched off 4 months of violence. One year later, how does the situation look?
So I was there a couple of weeks ago, and I spent about 6 weeks in the Kashmir Valley with my family. The situation is just as volatile, it is just as unpredictable and uncertain as it was after the assassination of the young militant commander who was killed a year ago. Even now, educational institutions are closed. They have been closed for a very long time. So the future of the younger generation is terribly uncertain, precariously perched. And economically, the state has been suffering for the past 1 year. Kashmir relies, in addition to agriculture, Kashmir relies a lot on tourism as well. And because of the political uncertainty, because of the inability of the government and police as well as paramilitary forces to guarantee the security of tourists, we didn't see very many domestic or foreign tourists in Kashmir this year. So the tourism sector has taken a terrible hit, which has been debilitating for several people in that part of the world. And even now, I see a terrible anger in the younger generation. I see a growing alienation and a growing resentment, which has yet to be addressed by the state government as well as by the federal government. Instead of alienating young people and marginalizing them even more, I think it is important to take cognizance of their aspirations, to take cognizance of the voice of millennials, of the younger generation, to incorporate them into the mainstream, and to make them feel like political stakeholders so that they know that their voice counts.
With the alienation of young people, how stable is Kashmir?
For our younger generation, for what we call, my daughter laughs at me when I use the term net generation, but that's what I call millennials. So for the net generation, politics in Kashmir is an abstract concept. They have not been able to see politics as the path or the concrete way to bring about political as well as socioeconomic transformations. Young people, the net generation or Generation Y, as we call them, do not have access to their political representatives, to their legislators, to people who would listen to their demands and recommendations and bring about changes legislatively. So it is important for young people to gain that access. And right now, what I saw on the streets of Kashmir was, as I said a little while ago, a lot of unpredictability. The situation can change overnight. People leave their homes in the morning to go to work, thinking that the day will be perfectly normal, but they never know if they will return in one piece or not, if they will return, if the day will pass by smoothly, peacefully. That's how unpredictable it is as we speak.
Young people in Kashmir are accustomed to violence related to elections. Mm-hmm. That's what they've grown up with. Mm-hmm. When you have young people disillusioned in such a way about their government, about their institutions, what does that do to trust and the feeling that there is a better world ahead?
I think that's a great question. So one of the biggest issues in Kashmir as of now is the trust deficit. Young people do not trust their elected representatives. They do not trust non-state actors who are the separatists, who are anti-India, and some of them are pro-Pakistan. There is a trust deficit between most Kashmiris and the federal Indian government. The way to heal that society, the way to build confidence, to repair the socio-political structure, is to rebuild trust, is to initiate confidence-building measures, one of which is holding free and fair elections. The other is to incorporate young people into the mainstream, to make them feel like they belong, like they are political stakeholders, to hold dialogues, to negotiate with state actors, so elected representatives, as well as separatist organizations, to look for political accommodations. There will be no black and white solution to the Kashmir conflict. We will require compromise. We will require political accommodations to be made, negotiations to be made. And the way to do that is through dialogue. There is no other way. I think the institutional disrepair that we see in Kashmir as of now is damaging psychologically to the social fabric and is leading to even greater social fragmentation right now. The disrepair of democratic institutions, the loss of faith in democracy, the loss of faith in constitutional reform, all that needs to be repaired because that is the only way to a peaceful transformation, to growth.
How influential are the young militants in Kashmir?
There is a section of young people that romanticizes militancy, that romanticizes the gun culture that has been prevalent in Kashmir since 1989. There is a section there that sees violence as the only way to win their rights, to claim what they see as rightfully theirs. But there is another constituency, a growing constituency for peace, which sees violence, which sees the prevalent gun culture as terribly damaging, not just to democratic institutions, but to the socioeconomic fabric, to our very pluralistic cultural fabric in which I was raised. So that growing constituency for peace must be encouraged by the federal Indian government, by the state government, as well as by the international community. We have already lost one generation in Kashmir. I do not want Kashmir to lose one more generation. I do not see martyrdom as the way out of a political conflict. I do not see physical and economic sacrifice as the way out of a political conflict. I see the rebuilding of a pluralistic society.
You mentioned pluralism. It's essential for a vibrant democracy. Mm-hmm. Is that possible in such a region?
Well, I grew up in Kashmir in the 1970s and the 1980s, and the culture that I was raised in was composite. It was pluralistic. I was raised within a secular framework in which Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, and Sikhs had their distinct religious identities, were free to practice their religious faiths, but within a secular framework. I was educated in a Catholic school in Kashmir, which was run by Irish nuns. And I was encouraged, not just by the nuns of the school, but by my family as well, to go to the school chapel every afternoon after recess. And we would go to that chapel with utmost reverence, with faith and respect, the same reverence with which I would go to a mosque or a shrine with my family. And that culture gave people of my generation a broad outlook. Our horizons were broadened. We were a lot more cosmopolitan than the younger generation that I see now in several parts of South Asia, not just Kashmir. And I think it is important for young people in South Asia and in other parts of the world as well to focus on building broad-based coalitions that transcend organizational divides, that transcend religious divides. Because a monocultural society, not just in South Asia, but in the United States as well, would be the bane of our existence. We have grown up with diversity, and diversity, as you correctly pointed out, pluralism, is the hallmark of a vibrant democracy. And that's what we need to bring back. That's what we need to revive.
People in the United States often criticize the election process in this country. But in Kashmir and other states in South Asia, elections often see violent acts. Earlier this year in April, there was a call for an election to be canceled because of violence. Schools were burned that were polling places. Turnout was low because people were scared and there was a threat of violence. How does that affect the people when their political system is challenged constantly?
So what I see in Kashmir today is a depoliticization of that society. I think a lot of young people are beginning to realize that the lack of participation in the election process, the lack of participation in other political processes, might be a short-term way to show anger or resentment, or a short-term way to show rebellion. But it really does not lead to any kind of constructive solution. The reason I say it leads to that it leads to depoliticization is because when the turnout in an election is very low, the person who is elected to office, either parliament or the legislative assembly, does not really enjoy the mandate that would give him or her the right to bring about political or socioeconomic transformations or changes. The elected representative, because of the low turnout, lacks credibility and is not taken seriously enough in other parts of India. And also, the federal government, as has been done in the past, imposes rulers on the people of the state, imposes rulers whom the people might not be able to relate to, whom the people might not have faith and trust in. So this is how I see it. The election process in a conflict zone, in and of itself, is not an end, but is the means to nation building, is the means to bringing about constructive socioeconomic transformations. We can continue to talk about greater autonomy for Kashmir. We can continue to talk about the right of self-determination, which is recognized by the United Nations, for the people of Kashmir. But that should not deter us from participating in elections, which are the means, which are the way to ensure quasi-stability, security, and the way to build our nation, the way to rebuild democratic institutions, the way to bring about constitutional reforms for the betterment of the populace of Kashmir, and to actually implement those constitutional reforms in institutions, so to see institutional change.
Once the system is compromised, how difficult is it to get people past the stigma associated with their electoral process, where they don't believe in the system, where they're afraid of the system, where the system doesn't work for them, and where they feel disenfranchised?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good question. Because the electoral process in Kashmir has been stigmatized, and state actors or elected politicians, elected representatives, for a while, particularly right around the early 1990s, were politically as well as socially ostracized because people had no faith at all in them. But here is how I see it. In order to remove that stigma from the electoral process, in order to ensure a certain credibility to the electoral process and elections, it is now important for young people from all walks of life, of all ideological and political leanings, to become a lot more politically active. Instead of watching, observing from the sidelines and criticizing and being skeptical and questioning every political move that is made either by the state government or the federal government, I think they need to regain access to mainstream politics, not to become compromised, not to get co-opted, but in order to bring about positive, constructive change that would enable the growth of accountability, that would enable the growth of transparency. What we are seeing in the political and the election process in Kashmir as of now, not just Kashmir, but other parts of South Asia as well, is a lack of accountability, is a lack of transparency. And in order to ensure accountability, young people, as I said, need to get more involved, not just people who belong to political dynasties, or not just people who have been affiliated with a mainstream political organization for generations, but others as well, because everyone is a political stakeholder. Any young person who can bring positive change, constructive change to the table, can be a player in the process of nation building, needs to get involved. That is important.
Women have also been involved in the political process in Kashmir through the women's militia. Feminists have played a role. How important is the women's movement in Kashmir in relation to the development of democracy?
The women's movement in 1947, you mentioned the women's militia. And in 1947, those involved in the women's militia were from several walks of life and of various religious, political, and ideological leanings. In that organization, they were able to transcend those divides and come together to fend off those militaries that were antithetical to the growth of a political consciousness, to the growth of nationhood in Kashmir. In 1947, members of the women's militia walked hand in hand and shoulder to shoulder with their male counterparts to play an important role, not just in adult literacy, not just in ensuring the growth of access of everyone to the political process, to their political representatives, but they played a great role in trying to bring about an egalitarian society as well, in which women could participate in political processes. But soon after, Kashmir became a part of India, but soon after Kashmir acceded to India in 1947, members of the women's militia were again relegated to the background, again relegated to home and hearth, as we saw in this country after World War II, right? Women who were politically active during World War II, after the end of the war, were again relegated to home and hearth, to the background, which is exactly what we saw in Kashmir. What we have been seeing for the past several years is the participation of women in political processes, in the election process, but in very small numbers, in limited numbers. And we have been seeing token women in the Legislative Assembly as well as the Indian Parliament. And by token women, I mean women who feel compelled to toe a very militaristic and masculine line, because they are afraid that if they talk about the peace process, if they talk about diplomacy and negotiations, they would be seen as overly maternal and too soft and not credible enough to be involved in politics. Currently, the head of government in Kashmir is a woman. But again, I would say she toes a militaristic line. She toes a masculinist line. And I think it is important for women in various parts of the world to rekindle their historic ties with peace, the peace process, diplomacy, negotiations, dialogue, and to be harbingers of a new beginning for a conflict zone like Kashmir. We need to see a greater number of women in parliament, in the legislative assembly, in the judiciary, which would bring about structural change, which would bring about, hopefully, more accountability, more empathy, which is what is required at this time.
In the last several years, how effective has the West, the United States in particular, been in the region, especially in dealing with the conflict between India and Pakistan?
The West, as you know, particularly the United States, has been a very old ally of Pakistan. And in the past couple of years, the relationship of the United States with India has improved to a very great extent. India is a burgeoning economic superpower in that region. And of course, the United States wouldn't want to sever its ties with India at this point in time. So they have been very cautious about getting involved in any conflict in that part of the world, particularly in a conflict that has been labeled an internal Indian issue, and I would place that within quotes. So the approach of the United States has been very diplomatic, and they look or have been terming Kashmir a bilateral issue between India and Pakistan, and have been calling for the resolution of the Kashmir conflict by India and Pakistan, but without taking any kind of responsibility or without trying to assume a larger role.
How has the proximity of and the influence of China affected the West's reaction to politics in the region?
Okay, here is what I would say. China has growing economic interests in Pakistan with the building of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which would increase connectivity between Pakistan and China, and which would be very lucrative for both countries. And China has been building, has invested quite a lot in railroads, infrastructure, etc., in Pakistan, which is why they do not want to see the right of the government of Pakistan over Pakistani-administered Kashmir being questioned. So when it comes to human rights violations in Indian-administered Kashmir, when it comes to the right of self-determination of the people of Indian-administered Kashmir, China is very supportive politically and very vocal as well in condemning human rights violations that Indian military and paramilitary troops have been responsible for. But when it comes to the right of self-determination of the people of Pakistan-administered Kashmir, as well as any curbing of political and human rights in Pakistan-administered Kashmir, China maintains a discreet silence. Now, the economic corridor that China is building in Pakistan would go through one part of Pakistan-administered Kashmir. It would go through Gilgit and Baltistan. So for China, the greater integration of Pakistan-administered Kashmir into the mainstream, into mainland Pakistan, would work in its favor, which is why they never talk about the reunification of all three parts of the state of Kashmir. But they focus only on the political rights of the people of Indian-administered Kashmir. You see, is that answer clear? Did that make sense? So just to clarify for your listeners, Gilgit and Baltistan are parts of Pakistan-administered Kashmir. Muzaffarabad and Mirpur are parts of Pakistan-administered Kashmir. The part that I am from, the Kashmir Valley, is part of Indian-administered Kashmir. With China having invested billions of dollars in the economic corridor that it is building in Pakistan that would go through Gilgit and Baltistan, it wants the government of Pakistan to be able to ensure the security of that economic corridor, to be able to ensure the access to the port, the Gwadar port that China would gain. And that can only be done when the government of Pakistan has greater control over Pakistan-administered Kashmir, in this case, over Gilgit and Baltistan. So they wouldn't want to encourage any movement for independence or separation, any militant movement or any movement of political resistance in that part.
With its various challenges, what is the near-term future for Kashmir?
Well, at this point, it is very difficult to predict what the near-term future of Kashmir is. But the way I see it, the solution to Kashmir cannot be a military one. It has to be political. India is one of the stakeholders in the Kashmir conflict. Pakistan is the other. And now China lays claim as well, so we need to take that into cognizance also. In the near future, I ideally would like to see the growth of peace. I would like to see the growth of diplomacy. I would like to see constitutional reform, structural change. I would like to see more accountability, not just politicians being held accountable, but military, paramilitary personnel, as well as members of the civil society. So we need to see the revival of democratic institutions. We need to see the revival of the election process that is free and fair and that guarantees the participation of people from all walks of life. As of now, I think the immediate concern of the state government of Kashmir, the federal government of India, as well as the government of Pakistan, should be to ensure the safety and security of our young people, should be to ensure that their political voice will be recognized, that they will be guaranteed that they are capable of standing up for themselves, being counted, that they will be seen as stakeholders in the political process. That should be the immediate goal of these governments. And also, what I have been seeing in the past several years is the growing interference of the military in democratic institutions in Kashmir. We have been seeing the interference of the military in civil and democratic institutions in Pakistan for a very, very long time, with the several military dictatorships in that country, some of which, by the way, were supported by the United States, including Zia-ul-Haq's regime, which was dictatorial. But there needs to be a line of demarcation between issues of national security and issues of national interest. The forte of the military is the border. The forte of the military is national security, not foreign policy, not national interest. And the blurring of that line is when democratic institutions begin to weaken.
Many nations are flying through turbulence. There are changes happening around the world. With its history of conflict, what is the lesson that the rest of the world may take using Kashmir as a case study?
Kashmir has been reduced to a battlefield by two nuclear powers, India and Pakistan. Particularly the Kashmir Valley, which is the part of the state that I am from and where my family still lives. I think the lesson that other conflict zones can take away from Kashmir is that as of now, our younger generation has been reduced to cannon fodder. As of now, our society has been depoliticized. As of now, our cultural fabric, as well as our socioeconomic fabric, are terribly fragmented. I wouldn't say beyond disrepair, because I will not lose hope, but they are terribly fragmented. The future looks bleak. A lot of people involved in the conflict, including gun-toting young people, don't really know what they are fighting for, don't really know what is at the end of the road. So right now, Kashmir is a nation divided against itself. And as Abraham Lincoln reminded us in 1858, a house divided against itself cannot stand. That's the lesson that conflict zones need to take away. We cannot lose the goal of building a nation. We cannot lose sight of the goal of constructive socioeconomic reform and repair. We cannot lose sight of the goal of building a stable future for our younger generation so that they don't lose the will to live. I think that is the worst thing that can happen to young people, when they lose the will to live because they see no future for themselves. So martyrdom becomes an ideology. There is no other substantive political ideology for these people to hold on to. And that is depressing. That is terribly dismal.
Well, I hate to end there on a dismal note, but Naila Ali Khan, thank you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you.